This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Live from Seahawks training camp, powered through the Alaska Airlines studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our Seahawks training camp coverage is presented by Precor Home Fitness as we continue live from the VMAC. Talking a lot of football, but we got to talk baseball. Mariners completed the sweep today. They are three games back in the wild card, 10 games over 500 with 40 to go. It is unbelievable. And here to tell us why it's happening and why it's just going to be a magical end of this season is the one, the only John Morosi, who joins us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Hello, John.
Dave and Bob, I'm doing outstanding. I was actually calling in to get the early scouting report on the Seahawks for that Week 17 clash against the Lions. now, by which point, January the 2nd of 2022, maybe the Lions are closing in on a playoff berth. That game could mean a lot right there. What do you think?
Now, let me ask you, John Paul.
Probably not right about that.
No? How about this? Is Dan Campbell still the head coach?
I understand it's been a rocky start to training camp for the Lions a little bit here, but I would say that, believe me, we have seen here in Detroit, we're coming up now on 30 years since the last playoff game victory.
Of course,
at least one of those losses was to Seattle in the playoffs. I remember that game well. So we're coming up on 30 years without a single playoff win, and the Lions have one playoff win since my dad was 5 years old, I think.
Oy.
So that's covering some time there. That's why whenever there's any lament of, should the Seahawks have won more Super Bowls, that sentence has never actually been uttered in the state of Michigan before. I'm actually the first person to say those words aloud in my home state. So Seattle's had a great run. And we'll see if the Lions are up to the task there on January the 2nd there at Lumen Field.
Well, it's much like the Mariners in World Series being used in the
That's
same
right.
sentence. It's
Very
just
true.
Not happened. So
That's right. Well, I'll tell you this, and then we can move on to baseball. But the one time that I saw this, it was actually a great headline in the Detroit Free Press when the rights to host the Super Bowl, which, of course, the Seahawks played in the great city of Detroit, when the right to host that Super Bowl was awarded to the city of Detroit, the headline in the Free Press the next morning said, Detroit wins the Super Bowl. And it's the only time it's ever been true.
Oh, my goodness. All right, let's talk some baseball, John.
Sounds
and this Mariner
good.
Team, we've been talking about it all season. It's not sustainable. They can't do it. And here they are. They're still at minus 42 in the run differential, and we're looking at a team that is now 10 games over 500. They tried to give the game away today. They didn't. They ended up winning, completing the sweep, and sitting three games behind the wild card. What do you make of what you've seen? I mean, they're not a team that produces a lot of offense, and they've got a knack for holding teams down for the most part and winning with their pitching. Is it sustainable through the rest of the season, which there's very little left to work with?
Well, it's a great question, and here's how I look at it. The Mariners and the run differential conversation has been a big part of their year. I am personally ready to move past it from this standpoint. All that matters now, from now until the rest of the season, is the answer to this question. Can you play better than the Oakland A's from now until the end of the year? That's really it. That's it. Because one of the two wild cards is going to be either the Yankees or Red Sox. I'm pretty sure of that. And the other one is going to come out of the West. I'm pretty sure of that. And so when you look at the dynamics of the division, the Mariners right now are three games back of Oakland, and they play each other nine more times. From where I sit, and again, we'll have to see how things play out against the rest of the division and the rest of the league, but you certainly have to win, I believe, to have a chance at catching Oakland. You've got to win those nine games by at least 5-4. Optimally, it's 6-3. But you have to win the rest of the season series against the team you're chasing. That's what it all comes down to. The run differential is good to talk about, and it's so interesting because I'm on the radio a lot in Toronto, and it's the opposite conversation there. The Blue Jays are losing ground. They've got a tremendous run differential, and my answer to them, if they ask me the question, is forget about it. The only question that they have to answer is, can they find a way to finish ahead of Boston and New York? Because they have to do that. But for Seattle, it's much simpler. You got to finish ahead of Oakland, and that's it. And it's not easy because Oakland's a good ball club, but it's a three-game deficit, and you got to find a way to play better than Oakland by three games at least or more between now and the end of the year. They can do it, but they really have to have continued success, which has been really timely home runs and a rotation that's been good enough. And certainly today, Flexen pitched great. Obviously, there was a lot of drama after he pitched, but the rotation has been certainly good enough to give him a chance to win more often than not, and they just need that timely offense from the likes of Haniger and Seager to keep coming, and then they've got a chance.
Yeah, today it was Seager, Haniger, and Ty France, right? And
right.
Then, mm-hmm. You know, Ben, I don't know how much you watch, but, you know, the festivities began with Misevich giving up a double that scored, but it really got worse when Castillo got in. He gave up the bulk of the runs. Are you still thinking about Kendall Graveman when Castillo has this? How long is this going to go on for? I mean, it's not been good. I mean, we didn't see anything like this from Graveman, and I'm sorry to bring it up.
No, it's a fair point. And here's the interesting part, and I'm glad you referenced that trade, because I think for so many fans of the Mariners, everything goes back to that trade and how the team has played since then. Did that help or hurt the team? Well, since that day, July the 26th, the Mariners are 11-10 with I'll use the run differential again, with a +7 run differential. So they've played, again, better than .500, but they had to come back and win this game today for that to be the case. If they hadn't, it would have been 10-11. So they've been just okay since then. And in the process of playing just okay, what has happened the last few weeks in that same time is the Yankees have caught fire like nobody's business. And so on the day of that trade, as we remember well, they won that day against Houston, that Monday, to close within one game of the wild card, the second wild card. And now, of course, as we just documented, they're three games back. So they've lost ground since that trade. They've had a lot of dramatic performances, a lot of important wins like today, but the collective has been they've lost ground, and they've had days melt off the schedule, obviously, since then, almost a month's worth of games. So I think that we can say the bullpen has not been as effective since Graveman has left. I think that's correct. I think part of the reason you'd have to say is the way certainly that Castillo has pitched. Although we have to make this point too, Joe Smith has not allowed an earned run yet since he's been a Mariner. And Casey Sadler has pitched very well. Steckenrider's been pretty good. So that, I mean, they've actually overall, the bullpen has not been the reason, I don't think necessarily, that they've been treading water. I just think that overall they've always been a team that's kind of played on the razor's edge this season. And so do they miss Graveman? Yes, they do. Is his absence the reason why they've lost two games in the standings over the last few weeks? It's one of the reasons. And I think to your point about Castillo, it does make you wonder, do they have to go to a different option to close the ball game, and do they give a more of a look to Steckenrider in the ninth inning? That might be the next place they go, because I still think they've, to your point, they've lacked that stability of when Graveman was in the game early, they knew the game was over. And it certainly does not feel that way now, and today's game was one more example of that.
Do you trust Castillo? He's a guy I just don't trust. I know what his history is. I could look at his numbers and see the success that he had in Tampa, but as Dave mentioned, and anybody that's watched, he's been shaky here at best. He's not a guy that tends to go out there and just boom, 1-2-3, no doubt about it. He's got this one in the bag. He gets through, but boy, he makes it really uncomfortable. And yeah, you know, if we're getting to, you know, the last handful of games and they're still right on the cusp, I'm looking at Scott going, boy, I'm feeling like Montero's there again. And why would you put him out there? Why would you run him out there in a high leverage situation? I haven't seen enough of him in this situation to develop trust, and what I have seen hasn't given me any reason to trust. Where are you at with him?
I'm right there with you. And he, you know, he right now he has in his 9 1/3 innings, he's walked 5 batters and he's struck out 8. He's someone that still misses bats, and that's why they like him there. But you look at the other options, and Sadler, you could say, well, Casey Sadler plays a really important role in the bullpen, and you want to necessarily move him back later. I do think Steckenrider might be the one option because he has been around for a while, a veteran. But again, he's not someone that misses a ton of bats either. He's not a huge strikeout guy. So
what about Seawald?
That's a possibility. I think Seawald could certainly fit that description. I mean, he's someone that walks almost no one. And I think he obviously has recorded three saves too. So maybe he's the option. And obviously he was important again today. He may be where they go. And this actually might be to the point where the Mariners might be fortunate that they didn't lose the game today, where if they come back and say, listen, we just can't go with Castillo anymore as the closer. We have to sort of back away from him a little bit in that role. And they were able to reach that conclusion without it costing them a game today. That might be the one silver lining of all the tumult of this game. But Seawald might be the next best option. That's a very good point. It's tough for them, and I'm sure Castillo is sensitive to this. He has to know that coming in, that the series of trades that produced him as a Mariner were not the most popular from the standpoint of the clubhouse, we know that, and the fan base. And so that's a tough way to come into a team. And that's why anytime you make a move in July, guys, there's always a lot of delicate chemistry questions that come into play. And I think for the Mariners right now, they really haven't quite gotten in sync as a bullpen. And maybe the answer is turn it over to Seawald, turn it over to Steckenrider, and then let Castillo hopefully settle into a different role there.
John Paul, when he got here, Ty France, you know, all we talked about was his bat, and you know, I know that there were some reports of his defense not being great, but over at first base, and today he had an aware throw. It was a double play that didn't develop, but it wasn't his fault. He, you know, it was a throw that took him off the bag, but
right.
He made the snap throw over to third base to get the tag out. And the other night against in the series against Toronto, where he had the over the shoulder catch and the throw home. I mean, he seems to be getting better on defense, and it's kind of funny. We talk about players and go, well, you know, it's not as if these guys can't improve, and he seems to be improving and maybe can be one of your, you know, can improve enough to be that first baseman.
Right. Well, and that's where I think we have to give, and you make a lot of very good points. I think that's where we have to give Jerry some credit, too. It's why this team is so much fun to talk about, because they give you enough things to be frustrated about that we just covered with the bullpen and the trades in general, and yet the last two trade deadlines, last year, Jerry brings in Ty France, who was just not getting the opportunity in San Diego. They bring him in, and now it looks like he might be the future first baseman. He's played very consistently, and to your point, improved a lot defensively. And then right beside him on the infield is Toro, who has played well by all accounts. And since Toro has come in, he's basically become the everyday second baseman. He's started every single game over the last 20 about, and has played well. So when you think about trade deadline moves, if you're able to make a couple moves at the deadline, which don't necessarily bring you in a future Hall of Famer, but gives you at least a consistent everyday player, those are good trades. And that's where the Graveman deal, there's no question that it created some short-term disruption. Mm-hmm. But if they're right about Toro, if they're right about who this guy is and who he can be, this trade has a chance to make a huge impact on this club for years to come. And Toro's played well, and France has played well, and that's where you have to credit the front office and say, while this decision might have been unpopular in the near term and may have had some negative elements to it, the positive is if you got an everyday player, that's a really good trade. And in a vacuum, if you went up to any GM, 30 GMs, and said, listen, if you trade a closer on an expiring contract and brings you back someone who's going to be part of your club, an everyday player is going to bat somewhere in the middle part of your lineup, would you make that trade? And I think 30 GMs would say yes. And so I think while we rightly criticize maybe the timing and the way things played out, you have to give Jerry credit too. And if Toro ends up being as good as he's been at different times in the last couple weeks, you have to say that trade actually has a chance to be a huge win for the Mariners.
That's a great point, man. I mean, I think, if Toro does work out famously, it's not like they're going to come out and say, hey, by the way, when you guys were criticizing that trade, you guys remember that? Huh?
Yeah.
Hey, look at him
now,
right? So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's part of the frustration of being a GM, you know, but still, yeah, I mean, there's been more that have worked out, certainly a lot more. This one was just so, you know, the Graveman and, you know, with the Castillo thing, it was just so obvious and, you know, it was right from the get-go, everybody noticed
right.
it. But, yeah, you're right about that. It's, I guess that's just the torment of being, you know, a GM. Nobody ever looks at you when you make a great move, only when
right.
the bad moves come.
Right, exactly, and I'll tell you this too. I mean, at the end of the day, we have to also realize that you would probably say in the last 5 years, one of the more lopsided trades in baseball was the Mariners being able to unload Cano's contract, and oh, by the way, bring in Kelnick. And I realize Jared hasn't been brilliant, but he's been better the last, certainly since the start of August. He's looked more like himself. He's got an 840 OPS this month. That's been good to see. And so even if that was just an absolute gift of the contract, say, okay, we're just going to give you Robinson's contract and that's it, like, right now you'd still say that was a win. And oh, by the way, you've got Kelnick. You got a potential everyday center fielder for a long time. Huge win. So that's why Jerry's tenure has – there have been so many moves. There have been so many moves to talk about that you can – when you look at the roster, really kind of pick it apart. Like, wait, I like that move. I like that move. I like that move. I really think he's probably done on measure – he's done a better job on the plus side than on the negative side. I really believe that, even though certainly there are places to criticize. I think in general he's actually done a pretty good job.
How much credit do you give Scott Servais for where this team is right now? Because we just touched on where they could have folded, and it looked like they might have started to fold after that Graveman deal. Guys inside the clubhouse were not happy, and that was well known. That wasn't speculation. That was out there. You know, they've been without three-fifths of what was to be their starting rotation, John. Yeah. I mean, Paxton out after the first game. Sheffield, done, out. You lost relievers for the season. You lost your rookie of the year from last year. You've had guys go up and down and had a very mediocre offense at best, yet here they are, three games out of the wild card, 10 games over 500 with 40 to go. I mean, that's, you know, that's pushing the right buttons to me. That's a guy who's pushing the right buttons and maybe playing psychologist at the same time after that Graveman deal.
No, you're right, and I think Scott is a manager of the year candidate. I think he is. He's got a great demeanor about him, I think, especially for a tumultuous year. I mean, you've got a number of things going on here. You've got a young player coming in and Kelnick struggling. You had the Lewis injury. You had the spring training situation with Mather and the whole service time conversation. Then you had the unpopular trade. This season has demanded a steady hand at the wheel, and Scott has that. I think that, you know, Scott, people forget he had a long playing career in this game, and he was around a lot of really interesting personalities in his time. I've always respected Scott a lot for who he is and what he's done in the game of baseball. And let's not forget, he's from a small town in Wisconsin. And I think that there's a certain, I mean, I'm from a small town in Michigan, so I have a certain bias towards people who kind of have that same background. But I think he's got that ability to let things kind of settle in a little bit and have that easy conversation and not be too assertive about certain things. I think he's able to kind of let the conversation come to him and manage the room really well. And I think that demeanor that he has really served him very well. I think that he has been a steady hand in what's been a difficult year, and he's got this team I'll reference the run differential here because I think it's appropriate. This run differential is so out of whack with the way they're playing right now that clearly the manager's doing something right, and he's helping in a bullpen that's had players in and out. He's found a way to get things going there. He has welcomed new guys into the rotation. Marco obviously has been injured at different times. I mean, he really has done a tremendous job, and I think he is a manager of the year candidate in so many ways. And I think that easygoing demeanor, along with what is a very competitive baseball guy, because I think that's the other part of him. On the outside, you see this really comfortable conversation. He's an easy guy to talk to. I've talked to him a lot over the years. Really easy dialogue back and forth, but he's a competitor too, and don't let that fool you. So I think it's a really good combination of factors there for the Mariners that I think has made him, again, a manager of the year candidate who I think has done one of the best managerial jobs of anybody in Major League Baseball this year.
John, if the season ends this way, let's say they miss out on the wild card by 2, 3, 4 games, something like that. Do you think we're going to look at this as, man, you really missed an opportunity had you made a consequential move at the deadline? And by that, I mean moves like we saw the Yankees really go for it. We saw the A's pick up a player that is really producing for them. You saw Toronto make moves. Now, it's not working out for them so far. We'll see where they end up. But they're surrounded by teams that made these, you know, sort of big name moves, big time moves, whereas they went, you know, Tyler Anderson, okay, we bring in Toro, we don't know much about him, and the Castillo thing, which doesn't look great at this particular moment. Do you feel like we're going to look at it with some level of regret and say, boy, if you had swung a little bigger, maybe we're having a different conversation about the end of this season?
That's a great point, and I think that it's possible that we will. And that's been the lament multiple times before. We all know the near misses the Mariners have had in the playoffs in the last 15 years where they've gotten close and not been able to put the final piece over. And obviously, you could even go way back, and Lou Piniella still hasn't gotten that one bat he wanted back in 2001. So he's still waiting for that one. So Jeff Nelson's been waiting for that trade, too. He was talking about that, right? So I think that was one of the great quotes in Mariner history, I believe, going back. But I that's a little bit off topic. But I think that the general point here is this. Playoff drought aside, and it's a real thing, and I get it, and I covered one of those years in 2005. I know that the drought well, but I think the Mariners had to make the decision for this year based on the reality of this team and where they're at with their window, and Toronto's in a very different spot. They've got a couple key guys coming up on their free agent year, including Marcus Semien, Robbie Ray, Steven Matz in the rotation. Toronto's an all-in team. Oakland is an all-in team right now. New York is always an all-in team. Seattle, they're not behaving like an all-in team right now, and I would argue that they're not. They're not an all-in team right now. Look at the ages of some of the players and how many years of control you've got. They have, I would probably say, with Seager's deal up, and he's had a tremendous year, I think really from his standpoint, he's been a really important player on this team. They have that payroll flexibility coming up in the future where I think if you ask the Mariners, and if you probably asked any independent GM, hey, Seattle, better team today or a better team in 2023, they would say the latter. I think almost universally would be the answer. And I know fans don't want to hear that, but Jerry DePoto was not the GM in 2001 or 2007 or 2014 or any other year where they had a chance. He's the GM right now. And you have to deal with the team as it's in front of you. And I think Jerry sees correctly this team is going to be better next year than they are right now and into the future a little bit more. The one thing, though, I would say that merits a bit of a recalculation of where I would have liked to have seen them maybe make a little different approach is people said a couple years ago, look at how old Houston's team is and look at Verlander and look at Cole. They're not going to be that good for too much longer. Well, then all of a sudden this young pitching comes in. And Valdez and Javier and Luis Garcia, Houston's got a legit rotation that the Mariners are going to have a hard time surpassing unless these guys really click, like Gilbert and Kirby, Hancock. These guys have to all be really good for Seattle to have a better rotation homegrown than what Houston has for the next couple of years. And I think that's the one piece where maybe you say, oh, we could have gotten a little bit more, or maybe at the very least not traded Graveman to that team.
Right.
But that's I think you make a lot of very good points about how other teams handle the deadline. And, man, this is a fun team to talk about because it's a very second-guessable decision, and yet I understand the logic of why they went about things. It's just a difficult thing for me to have to say on the air to a fan base that's waiting for the playoffs and has been waiting for the playoffs. I get it. I started the conversation with the Lions. I get waiting. I understand
right,
that.
Right.
But it doesn't make it any easier, and I understand that too.
Hey, 30 seconds here. We're up against the break, but I've got to ask you this. I sent a note to these guys last night saying, if Shohei Ohtani is not a unanimous MVP, then something is crooked. Something stinks. We have never seen anything like this, John, in our lifetime. A guy doing what he's doing at the plate. He hit his 40th home run. He's 8-1 as a starting pitcher with a sub-3 ERA. I think it's 2.79. I mean, how is it even a conversation? With all due respect to Vlad Guerrero and everybody else, he's pitching like a dominant ace, and he's out there crushing the ball at the plate. It shouldn't even be a conversation.
But I agree. I mean, we're all playing for second place here. Everybody is. Everybody who's ever picked up a baseball bat and a ball, we're all playing for second place. No, I mean, he's amazing. And I thought it was great, the ovation he got in Detroit last night. I mean, people here in Michigan, people anywhere, people in Washington, everybody, they all realize what's going on here. We're seeing someone that we've never seen before. And I even, you know, I don't do this very often, but I got my daughters into the room last night. We got to watch Miguel. He's going to bat against Ohtani. Like these are moments. And I think Shohei is giving us a lot of these special moments as people who love the game and want to share it with our kids and our family members and our friends. It's just he's giving us these legitimate moments that are all-time baseball moments, and I'm just lucky to be able to watch it.
Yep, I'm with you. I'm with you. John, we love talking to you, man. Thanks so much, as always, and we look forward to catching up again very soon. And hopefully we're talking about a very close nip-and-tuck battle for that final wild card spot involving the Mariners.
Can't wait. Look forward to the conversation a couple weeks from now. We'll talk a little Michigan-Washington football, too. That's coming up. It's going to be a great time. And again, Lions-Seahawks, we'll have plenty of time to preview that for Week 17. Lots of conversation between now and then.
All right, John, we'll talk to you soon.
All the best, guys. You bet.
There you go. John Morosi, always a fun conversation with him. Coming up, we are going to get you set for this matchup against the Broncos this weekend. Brady Henderson of ESPN.com will join us as we continue live from the VMAC with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Live from Seahawks training camp
on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our Seahawks training camp coverage is presented by Precor Home Fitness as we get you set for game two of the preseason coming up with the Broncos this weekend. And here to break it all down for us, tell us exactly what's going to happen and why, is our buddy from ESPN.com. Well, I got to set the standard right now. Brady Henderson is here with us. How are you, man?
Play-by-play. I got the game plan. I'm going to tell you exactly what they're going to run.
How many snaps is this guy going to get? We were talking earlier, just sort of throwing the question out there for listeners and amongst ourselves in terms of what we want to see in this game, realistically, because I don't think we're going to see Russell play a half or, you know, Bobby Wagner or anything like that. But I'd like to see a little bit of what the offense may look like, because I don't think we really saw anything last week in terms of tempo, in terms of movement, and things like pre-snap movement, things like that. I'd like to see the defense get themselves off the field as opposed to last weekend where the time of possession was really lopsided. But for you, what are you looking to see in this game?
Yeah, I'd like to see them. I'd like to see a little more of the tempo. They did not do it last week, as you said, because I think they were more worried about just being functional on offense without, you know, Russell Wilson, without, you know, basically every starter on the offense set, with the exception of Kyle Fuller, who's competing for a starting job. I'd like to see more of that tempo, just because we know that that's going to be a big part of their offense. And I'm just interested to see what that looks like, because I've heard Jake Heaps talk about how there's a bunch of different modes that they can do that to. And I think not all tempo is going to look the same for them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're going to see them go no huddle. Sometimes you're going to see them maybe muddle huddle. See them get to the line and have Russell Wilson kind of run the show from there. So I'd like to see that. Again, we don't know if Russell is going to play. I think I kind of wonder if the situation at left tackle might play into that too. With we did see Jamarco Jones back at practice a little bit today. So that is a good sign for them that they would at least have their number two left tackle as opposed to their number three or four, whatever Stone Forsyth has been. But I just still wonder if Posick isn't out there and if you're still playing a backup at left tackle. I don't know how much, if at all, you want to put Russell Wilson in that situation. Then again, you're installing a new offense. You've only got three preseason games, one fewer than there has been. And so I'm sure they would ideally like to get him some work just so that they can kind of knock off some of the kinks in that offense.
I didn't prompt him to say anything about tempo, Dave. That's on his own.
Yeah, well, it's because you've been reading his articles.
That's why. Is that what it is?
He did say tempo, though. He did say it.
Bob Tempo Stelton.
That's my thing.
That's what we call
it. Is that
it
your new thing?
Yeah. I've been harping on it for a couple seasons.
It's just going to, if they go fast, they'll go straight to the Super Bowl.
At some point, not just foot on the gas, sprinkle it in.
But we were kind of also identifying, Brady, some of the players that we feel like really need to have good performances. You know, look, Alton Robinson, Rasheem Green, maybe Ryan Neal, they might have solidified their spots, and DJ Dallas too. But a couple of names, Rashad Penny and LJ Collier, mainly because they're both first-round draft choices. We've talked about them a lot. Seems like those are two guys that pretty much have to. Do you have any players you've identified that you think, or do you agree with those two guys?
I think with Penny, I mean, I think we know what he's going to be as long as he stays healthy. I hate to say this, but it kind of gotten to the point where I would almost be worried about him playing a lot in the preseason because of the injury situation is what it is. And I think as long as he's healthy, he's going to be the number two, and he's going to be that guy that is the quote-unquote 1-2 punch, which is a cliche that I hate throwing out there. But, you know, it looked at the start of camp, you know, he came back in here's another training camp cliche, the best shape of his life. Yeah. And he looked fast. You could tell he looked fast. And so it looked like, hey, maybe this could be the year that he is going to finally be that nice complimentary option to Chris Carson, which we've only seen in spurts. And then he missed some time with a thigh injury, and he got back this week. But I think he's going to be there as long as he's healthy. I think Trey Flowers is somebody I'm going to have my eye on. He's been up and down here. He's shown some flashes in training camp, and just the way that his contract is, he got a little CBA mandated raise to above $2 million. And I think I mentioned this last time. I just wonder if he doesn't win the starting job on the right side, how are they going to view that $2 million salary? Certainly he's worthy of a roster spot, but I wonder if they might view $2 million and change. I wonder if they might view that as being something that would make him vulnerable if he doesn't win a starting spot. And so I think he's definitely got something to play for. Kelo Weatherspoon, too, for that matter, on the left side. I would imagine, I don't know if I've seen anybody who's played well enough to really overtake him in that spot, but I also haven't seen enough of him to really think that, hey, that position is really going to be a strength of theirs.
As far as the running backs go, who will be the odd man or odd men out? So you think it's Carson. You think Penny's that guy. Then there's DJ Dallas, Alex Collins, Travis Homer. How does that shake out? Do you think they try to, maybe they sneak Homer onto the practice squad, or they keep four backs? How does that work out for you?
Yeah, I think when I did my roster projection a few weeks ago, I had Homer not making it just because he was injured at the time, and I wasn't going to put him on. And I had Alex Collins as their fourth running back behind Carson, Dallas, and Penny. The thing with the new rules with practice squads is a guy like Collins, who's been in the NFL for a while, who under previous rules would not have practice squad eligibility, he is eligible for the practice squad now. So maybe they stick him on the practice squad, and he's that veteran early down guy that they could call up if there is an injury to either Carson or Penny, which, as we've seen, that very well could happen. But I think Dallas certainly has solidified his spot as one of those. If they're keeping four, I think he's solidified his spot as one of those either third or fourth spots, and then it's just a matter of what happens with that other one. Collins looks trimmer and he looks quicker than he was earlier in his career. He's never been a guy who's got that top gear, but he looks faster and he looks like he's in better shape than he was earlier in his career. So it would not surprise me if he ends up taking one of those spots.
Any really quick here? We got the break coming up here, but any rookie free agents or just, long shot free agents, maybe for second year guys that you think that are playing well enough that you've seen out here that can make this roster?
Yeah, Cade Johnson, he had a couple nice plays today. He seems like of the undrafted, of the really young receivers who may be competing for that fifth, sixth spot, depending on how many they keep. He seems like a guy who was really at the front of that pack. I don't know if I'm saying his last name right, but Travis Toivonen. He seems like he catches everything that's thrown to him. He had a really nice catch on a fade today, beat Demarius Randall in a jump ball situation in the end zone. So he's a guy who every time they throw to him, he seems to catch it, and he's got really nice size. So those are a couple guys, two more guys to watch on Saturday.
Brady, we appreciate it, man. Good to talk to you.
Hey, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
There you go. Brady Henderson from ESPN.com does a great job covering the Seahawks for ESPN.com. We're going to come back, give you bonus Blowers, part two of our conversation with Mike Blowers, coming your way next with Wyman and Bob live from the VMAC on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wyman and Bob,
live from Seahawks training camp
on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our Seahawks training camp coverage is presented by Precor Home Fitness. Well, we gave you part one yesterday of our conversation with Mike Blowers, but you can't just keep him for 8-9 minutes. You got to get it all covered with Mike each and every week. So part two of our conversation started with the topic of Luis Torrens, and what has been the biggest difference the second time up with the big club compared to where he was the first time around?
Yeah, he's for me, he surprised me on two different levels, Bob, to your point. I expected him at the start of the season to be somebody very reliable and steady in the middle of the lineup. I didn't think that he would hit for a lot of power. I thought he would be just a good, solid right-handed hitter in your lineup because he showed us that. We've seen that from him. And so that's kind of what I expected. So when he got off to the slow start, I wasn't overly concerned, but when he couldn't just get himself out of it, and then you mentioned his defense was a struggle, and I just wondered if the whole thing was just combined together a little bit overwhelming for him, and he just had to go catch his breath. And I think going to AAA probably did that, because he didn't necessarily tear it up down there, but I think he got his mind right. So when he came back, he was ready to go, and I think that Scott, when he first came back, picked his spots to put him in where he felt like it was his best chance to help the club. I think DHing has helped him also, because it takes the stress of the defense off of him now that Cal is here with Murphy.
Hey, Kelnick, the other day, how important was that, him laying off those pitches? I think it was all four, like the first four, and the pitcher was trying to get him to chase. He has the walk-off walk. How important is that for the development of a young player? And then, you know, once the light kind of goes on for him, does it stay on, do you think, with Jared Kelnick?
Yeah, well, you know, we've talked about it with Jared and the process that he's gone through this year. It's been that difficult one for sure. But you have to start somewhere. And I think, you know, we talked about it a few weeks ago, and my comment was sometimes you have to crawl your way out of it. And he was, you know, in the depths of it, went back down, came back up. And he had to realize, and it's something that Scott has talked about too, and even Jared's talked about it, that you can't get it all back in one swing, in a game, or even in a week. It just doesn't work that way. And let's just try to find something positive to move forward from this point. And, you know, that's all I've talked about with him, is what happened at the beginning of the year when he was called up and things didn't go well is what it is, okay? And it's not surprising. It happens to young players all the time. You hope it doesn't, but it can happen, and you have to be prepared as an organization. And I think that they were. I'm not sure that Jared was. I think he's never failed before. But then he starts taking his walks. First he makes a mechanical change to where he can actually see the strike zone better. And all of a sudden he's not chasing those pitches off the plate like he was earlier. So he's, you know, there's the light, Dave. Aha, this is going to work for me because I feel so much better up here. He's taking his walks. He starts to square the ball up a little bit more. And then the most important thing is at some point you have to get paid off with some hits. And he had the walk-off, but he also hit a double to left field earlier in the game, which was he just absolutely torched the line drive out there. I'm not sure if it was the game after that or two games after that. He hits a home run out into the left field bullpen to show you some pop going the other way. I feel like his timing on the fastball has been much better. I just like where he's at right now. And I know he still gets frustrated at times, but that's part of being a young player. But he seems to shake it off a lot quicker.
Well, and I love what, you know, you look at his numbers for the month of August, and yeah, he's not blowing it up. He's hitting .235, but he's got an on-base percentage of .344, and it speaks to what you were just talking about. He's striking out a lot less. He's got 9 strikeouts so far, but he's also got 9 walks. So he is showing that patience. He is showing that eye. And you talk about his stance up there, Mike, and I think we've gone through this before, talking about, you know, Cal Ripken would change his stance from at-bat to at-bat. You did that as a player as well. Does that usually come at the urging of your manager, your hitting coach, when you're struggling? Because, you know, Cal may have been the exception. He would do it when he was succeeding. But it seems generally you see somebody change their stance, it's because it's not working. Something's not right, so they change it. In Kelnick's case, do you think that was him saying, I need to be more upright? Or is that the hitting coach getting to him? How does that process work?
Yeah, I think for Cal, when Cal first broke into the league and was a terrific player right from the jump, he had the same stance for a very long time. It was later in his career that he would change all the time, and I think a lot of that was because, one, he was playing every day, two, he was getting older, and his body just felt different from day to day, and he was smart enough and been around long enough to make those adjustments. So there's that one. A player, you know, that goes and makes his changes, they're usually pretty subtle, and it's over the course of a career. When you're a young player, and especially when you are – one of the frontline players, the organization as a whole will do little things here and there or have conversations with that player, but they're not going to make any changes with that player until that player fails. Because the player, as a young player, is not going to buy into it. Hey, I'm doing just fine the way I am. Why do you want to change me? Well, just because some people can see what's coming down the road, the young player doesn't always see that. And he's going to look at you and go, I'm doing just fine. Thank you very much. Until he fails. And then once you see that, he's more willing to listen and buy into. And it's not just Jared, it's every young player.
Hey, Mike, in 1988, I was a starting linebacker in the NFL and did a charity golf tournament or something. And Jay Buhner was at the golf tournament. And I remember he gave me a look. And I kind of gave him a look back like, do you want a shot at the title?
And I think he did, Mike. I think he did. And I always liked that about him. So I wanted to get a Jay Buhner story out of you. I know you touched on it a little bit during one of the broadcasts a couple of weeks ago, but you got any I'm sure you have some good Jay Buhner stories.
I have a lot of them. You know, one was, well, first of all, Jay is an awesome teammate. And everybody remembers when, you know, we were going through it in 95 and people were talking about the wild card and we were on fire. And Jay was the first one. He was fiery about it, too. Wild card, what are you talking about? We're going to win the division. People, you know, give that him a lot of credit for that. And he deserves it because he certainly was one of the leaders on the team. But I can remember when we ended up in that big brawl in Baltimore and Jay was out there basically trying to break things up. And somebody made the mistake of basically giving him a sucker punch. And he basically walked out of his uniform with people grabbing his jersey to go after this guy. And he finally ended up getting a hold of him, but it took basically our whole team to hold him back because he's a strong man and he was angry. And you get into that point, I mean, it's bad news for everybody. But the one thing with Jay to me, and this is something that he and I worked this out over a period of time, but my locker happened to be right next to Jay. Jay was on the corner. I was next to him and Tino Martinez sat next to me. And Jay is ADD. He cannot sit still. He just cannot do it. And we're in the clubhouse every day, and we're in the clubhouse after batting practice. And for whatever reason, Jay's got a bat in his hand, and I can't remember if it was a ping pong ball or those plastic golf balls, but he's ripping these things around the clubhouse. And then all of a sudden, he thinks he's got a baton. He's twirling this thing around and starting to ricochet off of lockers. And that was my job to go, Jay, that's enough. Somebody's going to get hurt, and it's probably going to be you, so why don't you come over and have a seat? And the first couple of times, he kind of gave me that same look, Dave.
Yeah.
And then we kind of worked it out like, dude, this is the best for everybody. And then he would just kind of look at me, give me this wink, and then come over and sit back down, and we talk about something. But that was Jay.
Give you the look. You talking to me?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. Who are you to talk to me? No, right. It's a team thing, Jay. Come on over and have a seat, partner.
Yeah, that's so funny. He was one of those guys when he was obviously playing when I was an intern, and my job used to be they'd go, Bob, you go in there, don't say anything. You just hold your mic up and get sound. You're right. You just be in that group around a locker, and everybody else would ask the questions, and you just don't screw it up. And back then, he was intimidating, I remember, because he would give that look kind of to everybody, to the reporters walking by. He just had that look like, what are you doing here? And yeah. He could be a little prickly. He could be a little unpleasant at times when he wanted to. But I know that look. I've seen it because he flashed it at the group of reporters very often.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, he has that look, but he's also one of the best teammates I've ever been around. He's one of the best as far as a person goes. He's an awesome person. But I think Jay has that look just in general. I think it just, you know, he walks around with it. Dave has it, too. I don't know what he's worried about. Dave, you have the same look.
Well, I shot him a look back, but, yeah, it probably would have been a good battle back in those days. But I think the other awesome thing about him is that he got Frank Costanza on Seinfeld to talk. What did you trade Buhner for?
Mike, you're the best. We love these conversations. We look forward to it every week. We'll do it again next week.
Yeah, well, let's do it.
There you go. There's Mike Blowers, who joins us every week talking baseball. A little programming note for tomorrow's show. We are going to have the head coach of your Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll, join us right out of the gates at 2 o'clock. So stay tuned for that coming up tomorrow. Just want to allow you to plan your day tomorrow.
That's right. Plan it around 2 o'clock.
Yeah, be present for that conversation. So Pete Carroll with us at 2 o'clock tomorrow. But coming up, we'll talk some more football. The professor, John Clayton, is going to join us next as we continue live at the VMAC with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.